At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
How what's happening in American factories helps us understand what's happening in the broader economy. Plus, what hot weather means for the way we work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal, who's on assignment in China covering Secretary Yellen's visit. More from him later this week. Today is Wednesday, July 5th. Good to have you with us. It's become something of a regular pastime, both here and elsewhere, to try and read the tea leaves and predict when and if this economy is going to slow down. Some economists have been warning for a while now about a possible recession as the Fed continues its efforts to fight inflation. Today, we got what looks like some hard evidence of a slowdown, in one sector anyway, manufacturing. The Commerce Department reported that factory orders in May were up, but by an underwhelming 0.3%. And Commerce revised the previous month's figure downward. Meanwhile, the Institute for Supply Management's Purchasing Managers Index, a survey that measures manufacturing activity, fell again in June for an eighth straight month. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us started.
Some parts of the economy are still chugging along, consumer spending, home building, and buying. But America's makers of stuff, manufacturers, have stalled out, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
In terms of production, in terms of employment, it's going nowhere fast, and it is, at this point, the weakest part of the broader economy.
This is a trend around the world, says Ariane Curtis at Capital Economics in London.
Manufacturing activity actually contracted at a global level at the end of the second quarter.
Soaring interest rates have made buying stuff, like appliances and factory equipment, more expensive. Meanwhile, consumers are spending less on goods and more on services that they missed out on during the pandemic. Plus, says Curtis,
supply chains are no longer an issue. They've worked through most of these backlogs of orders. So with the lack of demand, it means less activity.
And more financial trouble, says Dan North at Allianz Trade. His manufacturing clients buy insurance to protect themselves when customers don't pay their bills. And
we're seeing a very sharp increase in claims this year, an even sharper increase in past dues. That is when our clients tell us every month who is paying them late, how much they owe, how long has it been outstanding.
Now, keep in mind, manufacturing is not the be-all and end-all of the U.S. economy. It represents just over 10% of GDP. But Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics says it has outsized influence and tends to be an indicator of where the economy's headed. And while the near term may look mediocre, Zandi's more optimistic about the future.
You can see that in this surge in construction of manufacturing structures, of factories. I mean, since we reopened in the wake of the pandemic, manufacturing construction has more than doubled. It's going stratospheric.
driven by federal investment in green energy and the reshoring of high-tech supply chains. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, we got Fed minutes today, which sent things down a little bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Another area where economists in the private sector have been watching for signs of a slowdown is commercial real estate, specifically the office building sector. Vacancy rates remain a lot higher than they were before the pandemic, especially in urban downtowns. Well, a few weeks back, those warnings finally made their way to the Financial Stability Oversight Council. That's the panel here in Washington, D.C., chaired by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, charged with spotting any major threats to the economy. The council heard that banks may be exposed to a lot of risk because of loans they've made for commercial office projects, and smaller banks are holding an awful lot of these loans. So Marketplace's Justin Ho called up a few of them to ask how they're feeling about the office space sector and all those commercial real estate loans on their balance sheets.
The thing to understand about commercial real estate loans is that they're not really like traditional mortgages. Instead of borrowing at a fixed rate for 30 years, a commercial loan typically runs a lot shorter.
For my bank, we fix commercial loans for 5 years at a time.
That's Brad Bolton, president and CEO of Community Spirit Bank in Red Bay, Alabama. He says at the end of those 5 years, a borrower basically has to get a new loan with new terms.
They get a notice that says, hey, based on the contract, the rate has been reviewed. Here's your new rate.
In normal times, one advantage of short-term loans is that they make it easier for commercial borrowers to sell off buildings if they've gained a bunch of value. And if not,
the property can be refinanced at better terms.
That's Robert James II, CEO of Carver Financial Corporation, a minority-owned company with community banks in the South. He says these aren't normal times. Developers can't refinance on better terms because interest rates are a lot higher than they were 5 years ago. And so,
banks that have a lot of office-centric real estate, where they're expecting those loans to mature in the next 12 to 24 months, need to be very concerned about the quality of their loan portfolios.
The research company TREP estimates that a record amount of commercial real estate loans are maturing this year, with even more coming due in 2024. Matt Anderson is managing director of TREP. He says that means developers are going to be looking at different terms going forward.
With higher interest rates, they would qualify for only a smaller loan because those payments are going to be higher now.
A lot of building owners might have a hard time affording those higher payments right now because they're not pulling in as much rent as they were before the pandemic. That's especially true in New York, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and other coastal cities, says Nancy Wallace, a real estate professor at UC Berkeley.
And so there could be real pain in some of these markets that have especially problematic vacancy rates.
The situation's bad enough that some banks have slammed the brakes on new commercial real estate loans.
I know several of my friends in the banking sector that have stopped making CRE loans, period.
That's Dominic Miartin, CEO of Optus Bank in South Carolina. He says his bank is still making commercial real estate loans, but it's being a lot more cautious. That often means asking borrowers a lot of tough questions.
Who's going to lease it from you? Do you have someone identified? Do they have the capability? What industry are they in? Have you thought about what happens if they can't pay for 3 months? Do you have enough reserve money?
Miartin says banks are nervous that the owners of office buildings might default on their loans. If that happens, the bank has to take the building over and sell it, likely for pennies on the dollar.
The chances are a bank that is stuck with an office tower in one of those markets where there's been a significant decline in occupancy rates, that haircut could be massive.
Miartin says any bank in that situation is likely going to be pretty flexible with its existing borrowers to ensure it doesn't have to take over any office buildings in the first place. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you look at one of those maps that tracks temperature, you'll see a fair amount of the world right now is red, which is to say hot. very hot. So much so that yesterday, the world experienced its highest average temperature since we started keeping track. That's according to an analysis of federal data by the Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine. Heat affects our health, our morale, and our work. As temperatures become more extreme, both productivity and pay can take a hit. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on how we can cope.
It was 90 degrees at noon in Baltimore today, where contractor Prince Xavier Biabo is doing a gut renovation of an old townhouse. To stay hydrated, he says he drinks 2 gallons of water a day and eats about 20 slices of watermelon.
You know, till I get off of work. Then when I get home, I eat probably like 10 more.
You can smell the earth inside the townhouse Biabo's renovating. They're working in the shade on the ground floor, but there's no air conditioning or fan, and it's still really warm. Biabo says when it gets super hot, say triple digits, he can feel himself slowing down.
And it doesn't matter how much amount of water you would drink, you will feel tired.
That fatigue is common in high temperatures, says Patrick Baer, who studies adaptation to heat as an economist at the World Bank.
And that translates into meaningful reductions in productivity.
Baer says in years where the annual average temperature is 2 degrees higher, overall economic output falls by around 2% as workers slow down or need to stay home. He says there are adaptations employers can make. Requiring breaks and hydrating like Biabo does both reduce workplace injuries. And in some places in the American South, construction and road workers move to the night shift.
Part of that is because they're trying to minimize the negative effects of construction on traffic, but a big part of that is actually trying to keep the workers out of really high temperatures.
Baer says factory workers are affected too. And in the long term, we might see more manufacturing in cooler places.
You may just choose to move that facility from Texas to Minnesota, say.
Back in Maryland, Prince Xavier Biabo says he's doing his best to take care of himself so he can handle the changing weather.
Might be a little bit hotter, but when you do construction, it's like you got to deal with it.
Because we're likely to see more hottest days ever in the future. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The latest challenger to Twitter is set to arrive tomorrow. Threads is a new social messaging platform from Meta, which also controls Instagram and Facebook. This is one of many attempts to replace an ailing Twitter, whose users, at least the remaining ones, are becoming increasingly frustrated with the platform's changes and sometimes self-inflicted challenges. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on what exactly Threads is up against and what it has that other upstarts don't.
28-year-old New Yorker Isaac Lee used to be super into Twitter. Ever since Elon Musk took over, he's been more and more done with it.
I would say it was used originally for like connecting with people and random thoughts and even like learning about quick headlines. But none of those three things seem functional or like as useful as it used to be.
His feed doesn't show him what he wants to see anymore, and he says he will absolutely not pay for Twitter Blue. That's the subscription service with extra features like the ability to edit tweets.
I think it's stupid.
Over the weekend, Twitter imposed limits on how many tweets users can view. That did not do the company any favors among users.
Twitter is severely wounded.
Jasmine Enberg is a principal analyst with Insider Intelligence.
Meta Threads could deliver another major blow.
Out of all the challengers looking to push Twitter off its perch, Mastodon, Blue Sky, Truth Social, Discord, Tumblr, Noster, Threads has the most going for it, Enberg says. One of those things is Instagram, with an estimated 2.5 billion monthly active users.
Meta only needs roughly 1 in 4 Instagram users to use Threads monthly to make it as big as Twitter.
Threads is going to be connected to Instagram, and Meta doesn't need to convert Twitter's most diehard users, just some famous ones. Brian Weiser is principal of Madison and Wall Strategic Consultancy.
If a Kardashian, any one of them, or any of the top soccer players in the world, or Beyonce, or any of them start regularly using it starting tomorrow, I think it's inevitable that it will take off. But it's not a given that that happens.
Some users have trust issues when it comes to their privacy and the data Meta collects from them. And people accustomed to Twitter's almost anything goes culture may not find that in a more family-friendly community standards realm of Instagram. But if there is a moment when a newcomer could break through, Weezer says it is now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there's just nothing like that shark on the screen.
As long as it's on the screen, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 129 points, 0.4%, to finish at 34,288. The NASDAQ slipped 25 points, just under 0.2%, to close at 13,791. And the S&P 500 lost 8 points, 0.2%, to end at 4446. Justin Ho told us earlier about fears of a meltdown in commercial real estate. In that sector, CBRE Group, which manages over 4 billion square feet of space, gained 0.2%. Boston Properties, which owns more than 54 million square feet, shed 0.6%. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.92%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Even though the pandemic emergency ended a few months ago, many communities across the country still haven't recovered economically or socially. Chinatown neighborhoods across North America are a prime example. Early in the pandemic, as we talked about quite a bit at the time, many of these areas had a sharp uptick in anti-Asian sentiment and racist attacks. According to the group Stop AAPI Hate, more than 11,000 acts of anti-Asian discrimination have occurred in the U.S. since March of 2020. Now, community organizers from Chinatowns across North America are trying to work together to address some of these challenges. Amy Yee is a staff writer for Bloomberg City Lab, and she wrote about these efforts. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you attended this first-of-its-kind meeting in Vancouver focused on the economies of various Chinatowns across North America. So what prompted this meeting?
I think there's a recognition that there are a lot of existential challenges that Chinatowns face across North America. So it's a combination of many factors, but economic decline, gentrification, public safety, those are converging issues that many of these Chinatowns and Asian communities across the country face.
What are some of these specific economic issues that came up a lot at this conference that these communities seem to be experiencing really keenly right now?
Some of the economic challenges are, let's say, the plight of small businesses. Chinatowns are known for mom-and-pop shops and restaurants, groceries, the bakery salons, the things that make it a bustling commercial center. So many small businesses across the board are having challenges, and small businesses in Chinatowns especially so. And because of a confluence of factors, from public safety to the lack of access to government support. So the small businesses face challenges that are probably more acute than even the average small businesses, which are facing major problems as well.
There was a lot of anti-Asian sentiment, even violent attacks in Chinatowns early on in the pandemic, and many of those have continued. What's been the lasting impact of that kind of hate and discrimination on these neighborhoods?
I saw that for myself when I was in Vancouver Chinatown last year. That was my first time to Vancouver, and I was pretty shocked at the vandalism that I saw. Shattered storefront windows, historic murals that were defaced. You're going to hesitate to take your family or your children if there's open drug use or if people are shouting racial slurs at you, which did happen to me when I was there in May. People will tend to stay away if they don't feel safe, and it's very hard for a small business owner to keep their stores open.
It sounds like the economic recovery that some restaurants and other parts of the service industry have seen has not landed so equally on Chinatowns.
Yes, and it will vary from place to place. Every city is different, but that seems to be a common challenge. So let's say New York City Chinatown, which is a large Chinatown. During the pandemic, there was lots of data to show that the Chinatown faced a disproportionate negative impact from the pandemic, less foot traffic, and then there was also less government aid, ranging from small business loans called PPP loans to other kinds of government assistance, and fewer small businesses got those kinds of loans. So if you were already, disproportionately challenged, and then you couldn't access those loans, you'd just fall deeper into the hole. But, a good guess is that many of these small businesses have not recovered.
What do these businesses and community leaders from the various Chinatowns hope to accomplish with this new kind of coordination?
The conference was just a way for different kinds of advocates to share their experiences, to share lessons that could work, things that might be working, but also to seek support, because there is no silver bullet. It takes a lot more than individual advocates. You really need government support. Vancouver Chinatown, a year ago when I was there, it just seemed like there wasn't much hope. And I thought, this is a dying community, which is just a terrible shame since it's a historic place. But less than a year later, there has been a lot of government support. There's been a lot more funding allocated to Vancouver Chinatown, and advocates there feel hopeful. So that is a pretty inspirational and profound message to others.
Amy Yi is a staff writer at Bloomberg's City Lab. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The box office leader this weekend, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, brought in $82 million in its first 5 days. less than the studio was hoping for a more than $250 million film. There are still some big summer releases yet to come. You may have heard something about a Barbie movie. But the first half of the year has been a little meh for movie theaters. Stephanie Silverman is executive director of the Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee, which tends to have a slightly different marquee than the big theater chains. She sent us this dispatch.
You know, summer's shaping up really beautifully at the Belcourt. We actually had our second biggest opening weekend ever with Asteroid City a couple weekends ago, which was fabulous. And we're looking forward to lots more, but we're also seeing huge audiences, you know, show up for Jaws. There's just nothing like that shark on the screen. To be honest, it was kind of a slow roll up to this point this year. Costs are going up, man, just across the board. And that's from people to popcorn. We have not dramatically raised ticket prices, although that stress of affordability versus making sure we're covering our costs is always an issue. All things worry me, but I'm also an optimist. So, you know, there's a real conversation about movies and exhibition in theaters that absolutely moves the needle for us at the same time it's moving the needle for our big commercial colleagues. So, you know, having Tom Cruise talk about his love of movie theaters just matters. This summer is just really rich with those conversations. Plus, I mean, we're not showing both of them, but the notion of a Barbie-Oppenheimer double feature just, like, catching fire is a blast. My 16-year-old is already planning Barbie first, Oppenheimer second, or Oppenheimer first, Barbie second. Like, he and his friends are making a whole strategy to see both of these films on the same day. And I don't know that that was intentional, but I love that the artists and the filmmakers themselves are just attaching themselves to it and celebrating it, because it makes a world of difference for audiences when they see that. Beyond that, finally, the ground is being laid for a little bit of normalcy. And that's really about movie releasing. That's been the piece of the puzzle that has been weakened the most by the pandemic and that we're beginning to see ramping up. They're working the hardest to get out some of the bigger title movies that are sort of the big ticket Cineplex kind of films. And then our world is a little bit second rung, but we're finally seeing energy now in both of those, which is exciting. We're still on the COVID journey. There's no doubt. Every time I feel like we're coming out of it, there are funny new wrinkles, but this does feel like a really great, exciting movie summer, and like one we haven't seen in even pre-COVID for a little while. So that's really the best news for us.
That was Stephanie Silverman at the Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee. This final note on the way out today, like I mentioned early in the show, today the Fed released minutes from its June meeting with more details on what went into that decision to pause rate hikes. Basically, members of the Federal Open Market Committee want to let the impact of the rate hikes we've had so far settle in a bit before they decide when to raise rates again. And yes, I said when, not if. Basically, all the members of the FOMC said that additional rate increases this year would likely be, according to the minutes, appropriate. Here's your moment of economic context. Stephanie was talking earlier about the extreme hot weather in some parts of the country. While it can put a strain on our bodies and productivity, it also strains electricity grids. People were particularly worried about that in Texas, which is currently sweltering under a heat dome. But according to Texas Monthly, the grid there is holding up pretty well, thanks in large part to wind and solar energy, which on one of the hottest days last week produced 37% of the state's power needs. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.